genius plan before it gets off the ground, that will do it. If she feels threatened and talks to him about his relationship with you, this whole little plot could be toast. I watch her face in the mirror over the dresser. A crease appears between her brows, her self-confidence slipping faintly. How do you know? That she's noticed anything, I mean. What I wonder is how Brooke hasn't noticed. I thought girls were better tuned to each other than that. I was standing right next to her, and I'm observant. She makes a noise of derision I choose to ignore. She's noticing. So cool it yourself, or you may have to give my bed a try if you want to get laid. If the objects of our affections weren't showing up in 5 minutes, I would give that proposition a more enthusiastic effort.
Another offer to sleep with you. How sweet. I'm flattered. Have you forgotten what I told you last time?
It's almost impossible to associate this Brooke with the girl she was when I met her. Almost. I remember. I saunter closer, but she doesn't budge. She's always been tall and thin. Willowy, George would say. When I was 14 and she was 15, we were almost eye to eye up close. I've got several inches on her now. With her arms locked under her breasts, the view from my vantage point is greatly improved. I also remember what we were like together, even if we were just inexperienced kids. I shrug. Well, one of us was inexperienced. She's silent, but her eyes are furious. Every time we start to get into it, I want her to feel what I felt when I saw the photos and read the story that ended us. But that's not possible. She has no heart. And she managed to stomp the shit out of mine years ago. I'm playing games with a viper, and I damn well know it. I should feel sorry for Graham, but I don't really know him. He's got a girl I want, and I'm in the mood to be petty. Look. We've got time before the premiere. She and I have an interview schedule from hell, but that means we'll be around each other, a lot, without Graham's interference. I suggest you work on him from the same angle. He can't hang around L.A., he's got school. Isn't he graduating or something? Why don't you show up in New York for that? Hang around after. She nods, her poker face firmly in place. I'd already considered doing that. Good. Let's do it then. Divide and conquer. She's so outwardly cool, but her breaths are too shallow. I still say don't push her until I get to Graham. She'll turn you down on principle. Gotcha. We're 6 inches apart, and still, she isn't backing away.
I'm serious, Reed.
She puts one hand up to stop me, I suppose, but her hand is on bare skin, and her eyes widen, and I know we both feel the surge. So am I. She stares up at me like I'm some sort of twisted riddle, and then a knock sounds on the door, and she jumps, muttering, Jesus, under her breath. I button the shirt as I walk to the door. There's something gratifying about making an ex want you. Even for a second.
Chapter 13. Graham. I didn't sleep in Emma's room last night. There were no let's get hammered games in Reed's room since we have the final photo shoot today, but Brooke had no trouble convincing Tad to man the bar and shake up margaritas. Even though straight-up shots were out, everyone had enough tequila to tamp down inhibitions and loosen tongues, and Emma and I had just enough to be hazardous. I took one look at her half-masked eyes and knew I'd fail any test of having her in bed with nothing but boxers and T-shirts between us. Worse, I wanted to fail it, and we'd spent the whole evening not touching. My sexual history began with Zoe, followed by a self-imposed dry spell waiting for Kara to be born, and Zoe to come back around, which didn't happen. Next up, a sampling of indiscriminate college hookups. Nothing has been ultimately satisfying, and while I was capable of feeling turned on and wanting a physical connection, I never felt anything more intense. Nothing deeper. Nothing emotionally linked. Not until Emma. By the time I left her standing in that airport last October, I wanted so much with her that it scared the hell out of me. I hoped it would fade with time, and after the VF photo shoot in March, I felt confident I was getting over it. And then there she was, a month later, standing in that damned coffee shop, our eyes locked over Kara's head. My daughter had demanded hot chocolate after a dance rehearsal, shoving her cold little fingers under my sweater to prove her need for it. If we'd not stopped exactly there, exactly then, Emma and I would have never crossed paths when I didn't have my guard up. I'm not sure if I believe in fate, but this could be evidence of it. They call it falling in love because it's less like stepping and more like tripping. Tripping is the part where you're still trying to remain upright. I hadn't thought it was Zoe. I just fell right in, head first. With Emma, I fought it all the way down, and now I've lost. Emma, are you sleeping here? Me. Not a good idea tonight. She didn't answer for several minutes, during which I called myself all sorts of idiot, because that was an open invitation, as was the progressively unreserved look in her eyes all evening. I only wanted to be sure of her feelings, not make her wonder about mine. Me. This has nothing and everything to do with how much I want you. If I was in your bed tonight, after the alcohol, I want you. Trust me. Emma, I kind of feel like a hussy now. Me? No, that isn't what I mean. It's me. It would be too difficult. Tomorrow night, no drinking, and I can be good. Emma, well, damn it, you should have told me this before margaritas. I would have practiced my just say no. To alcohol, that is. Frowny face. Me? God, how do you make me laugh through this? Hussy indeed. I'm one nudge from coming to your room and ravishing you to hell. Emma. I want you to. Me. OMG, Emma. Dot, dot, dot. Emma. I'm sorry. Two rings? Three rings. Please don't go to voicemail, was running through my head. She answered, talking. Graham, I'm sorry, really, No, please, don't be sorry. That's why I'm calling you. I lie back on my bed, eyes closed. The alcohol buzz was diminishing, but not gone. Don't be sorry, Emma. My voice was almost a whisper. Do you remember those things I said I wanted to do to you? A few of our calls and Skype conversations over the past couple of weeks had reduced both of us to mush. Her reply was an exhalation of a pant. Yes. None of that has changed, increased, maybe. Some of those things are looking quite tame, in fact. Oh, God. I'm not even sure what that means. I pictured her lying back on her bed exactly as I was on mine. Yes, I know. Which is why we're waiting a bit.
But you're going back to New York.
Her sulky tone made me chuckle. Yes, and I'm coming back to L.A. in 3 weeks. Her sigh was faint. Not relieved or exasperated. Just accepting.
Okay,
she said, sounding so much like Kara when she doesn't get her way and she knows she isn't going to. I just don't want to take advantage of you or push you. Lies, lies, lies. I wanted her so bad I could conjure up her scent, imagine the feel of her skin under my fingertips.
But, Graham, I'm pushing you.
Yes, my voice is like a growl. So appropriate to the feral hunger coursing through my body. And in 3 weeks, I'm going to let you, if you still want to.
I will.
At 5:30 a.m., we meet in the lobby, which is deserted except for a bored desk clerk who gives us a disinterested once-over. Flashback to our mornings in Austin, up before everyone and heading out to run. I remember stepping out of the elevator and seeing her waiting in the lobby. Or getting there first and waiting for her, looking up at the soft chime, stainless steel doors swooshing open and delivering her to the ground floor. I love those mornings. I hand her a thermos when she comes to stand next to me, fighting the urge to slip my arms around her and kiss her. Ready? I ask, and she nods. Tossing the backpack onto one shoulder, I take her hand. This is a risk, if only to cross the lobby. I don't want her mortified over stories of multiple hookups like she was in Austin. So we have to remain a secret until after the premiere. I get that, but it still sucks. I packed water, bagels, and a blanket. I figured this morning was more about watching the sun rise and less about exercise. Her hand squeezes mine.
Sounds perfect.
The Jeep is ideal for the early morning drive in the cool weather, but not conducive to quiet conversation. We have to yell over the road noise to hear each other. Falling silent after a few minutes, we just hold hands and watch the street lamps start to pop off as the sky begins to lighten. I spent an hour on the internet last night, making sure the route to Griffith and the trail to take once we get there. The sun is already a half orb above the horizon by the time we get to the spot I mapped out and spread the blanket. Pressed together, we sip the coffee and watch what's left of the sunrise. Perhaps I should say she watches it while I watch her. I've seldom been this close to her and allowed myself the pleasure of staring, of drinking her in. All the seemingly trivial details. The indistinct image of a webcam never revealed the fine blondish hairs at her temple, and the darkness of her bed hides the freckle behind her ear and the blush across her cheeks when she realizes I'm examining her. Leaning to her, I tell her softly, "You're so beautiful." Her lashes lift as she glances into my eyes before closing hers. "No, you are." My mouth pulls up on one side. We're a little off the beaten path, but not so far that we can't hear people walking by, talking. "God," one of them says, stopping just out of sight where there's a perfect view of the sunrise. "So beautiful." Emma and I suppress our laughter, attempting to avoid detection. I kiss her softly. "See? He agrees with me," I whisper. She leans up, her hand on my jaw. "Maybe he agrees with me." When she starts to giggle, I cover her mouth with mine, partly to silence her, but mostly because I can't escape the need to kiss her again.
Reed. It hadn't occurred to me what a huge advantage this photo shoot is for getting Emma used to me touching her again. Not that she's particularly responding to it. I mourn the loss of that wistful, spellbound look she had back when we first began filming School Pride last August. But then again, the fact that she's less affected by me makes up for it. Yes, I'm one of those guys, more turned on by what I can't have than anything else. When you think about it, though, how surprising is that? When getting girls is as simple as deciding that you want one, no different really from deciding what to have for lunch, of course the ones who stand out will be the ones who don't come when called. Emma is like that pizza I can only get in one hole-in-the-wall place in the middle of Brooklyn and nowhere else. If I lived in Brooklyn, maybe it'd be no big deal. But I live in L.A. And goddamn do I hate it when I think about that pizza I can't have. We're on some estate in the L.A. hills, but the backdrop is very middle of nowhere. The grounds are rustic and native, but carefully cultivated to look that way rather than just left wild. My parents would probably hate it. Our lawn looks more like it belongs in the English countryside, bordering hedgerows and shaped shrubberies and roses, etc. It's impressive, but sort of laughable and out of sync at the same time. Emma is perched on the wooden slat seat of a swing attached to a high limb of a stories tall tree. Staring straight up through the branches, I wonder how they got the ropes attached that high. If someone climbed this tree like they might have done 100 years ago. Or if they brought in a truck with a ladder, or one of those bucket things like the guys who work on telephone lines use. While the photographer reframes the shot for what feels like the 100th time and we wait for instructions, I grip the ropes just over Emma's hands, my pinkies grazing her index fingers. "If we don't get a lunch break soon, I'm going to start nibbling on you," I murmur, careful not to lean too close. "I'm freaking starving." Emma's stomach growls just then, which makes both of us laugh. The photographer's head snaps up and he starts taking shots. Damn if I'm not thinking about that pizza now. And then Emma telling me yes in my room that afternoon last fall, hours before everything went to hell.
"Reed, go ahead and give her a gentle push."
I pull the swing back and let her go, and she swings out and right back to me. I've never tried to win a girl over by feigning friendship-only intentions, mostly because it seems counterintuitive. Brooke's plan isn't infallible, but if she succeeds in getting Graham in her bed, Emma will be distraught. And I'll be right there to assure she's desirable and provide emotional support, the sort of support everyone needs after discovering infidelity. She was attracted to me before. There's no reason those feelings can't be revived, with Graham out of the way. All I have to do is be patient. Not exactly my forte.
Chapter 14. Brooke. "Okay, people!" Elevating my voice above the music and general bar noise, I clank a spoon against my daiquiri glass until everyone looks my way. "We're here to celebrate, or mourn, depending on your interpretation of the event, the fact that our friend Michonne has decided to take this smokin' hot body, I pull her up from her chair and pirouette her in a circle, and give it to one guy for the rest of eternity. Boo, Tad says, hands cupped around his mouth, and everyone laughs. Tad Weiler, what the hell do you care what I do with my body? Michonne asks him. I'm objecting on general principle, he answers. Standing, he takes her hands and holds them out to her sides, scanning her curves in the tight little black dress she's wearing. Plus, it seems a shame to deprive the straight end of the male population of this sort of perfection. Michonne shoves him back into his seat with a laugh. The male population has mostly been deprived of it on personal principle. Smoothing her hands down her hips and cocking one eyebrow at him, she adds, This body is more discriminating than some others seated around this table. Hey now, Tad says. There's no need to talk about Quentin that way. Details of Quentin's on-again, off-again relationship with his childhood sweetheart, along with allegations of a few casual hookups around L.A., have been plaguing him for the past month. Apparently, Mr. Hottest Up-and-Coming Star played the field too close to a designated on period, and his girlfriend, who's close friends with his sister, caught wind of it and went on a tell-all rampage. Boys, they never learn. Dude, Quentin says, shaking his head, low. Anyway, I say, rolling my eyes and raising my glass, to Michonne. May she be happy with her computer guy, and may he be freaky in hot and stimulating ways. Michonne hides her face behind her hands as everyone clinks glasses. One of the bodyguards walks up behind Reed and leans over to speak to him in a low voice, pointing to a couple of girls, women, actually, standing off to the side. They're early 20s and hot. Not good, and no way for me to telepathically threaten him because he's pointedly refusing to look in my direction. As he slides from his chair and strolls over to his drooling fans, I try not to watch too closely because I don't want to call Emma's attention to him. Too late. Damn it, she's already watching him. He's smiling that easy, sexy smile, and the women are all stupid melty at the sight of him so close, in the flesh. One of them asks to squeeze his bicep. Hello, creepy. And when he consents, flexing, they both coo over him. Ugh. Directing the bodyguard to take their phones, he poses with each of them separately and together, their arms wrapped around his torso like seaweed. And then, still grinning, he shakes hands with each of them before turning and walking back to the table. I have to admit, I'm astonished. He didn't pull out his phone or jot a number on a napkin or confer with the bodyguard to escort them back to the hotel to await his pleasure. Nothing. Emma's head leans at the slightest angle, observing him. Glancing her way as he pulls his chair out, Reed smiles at her. When Meredith asks her a question and she turns to answer, he turns those stormy blue eyes on me, one eyebrow rising in a quick, nonverbal, see? I incline my head. Well done, smug son of a bitch. I signal the waiter for another round of daiquiris for Michonne and me, and scan everyone from my vantage point at the head of the table. Reed sits at the opposite end, now chatting with Quentin and knocking back another Jack and Coke. Jenna sits next to Quentin, and then Graham next to me. Michonne is on my right, then Tad, Emma, and Meredith. My eyes shift back to Emma, who's having a silent exchange with Graham as she sips her drink. I thought she'd ordered a Long Island iced tea. But from the looks of it, it appears she's drinking an actual iced tea. And Graham is either drinking straight-up vodka on the rocks or water. What the hell? Some reason you're going teetotaler tonight, Graham? I smile, chin in hand. Not planning on driving anywhere, I assume. His glance towards Emma and back is rapid, but not rapid enough for me to miss it. No, just not in the mood. I have an early flight tomorrow morning. Nothing worse than flying hungover. He says this as though he's ever in his life flown hungover, which I doubt. I've seen Graham under the influence, but never smashed. This is just another of his always-in-control qualities, one that used to bother me when I was in my phase of going hard and getting as trashed as humanly possible. I wanted him to join in. I didn't see then that getting liquored up and trying to seduce him was never going to work. Graham doesn't do drunken hookups. Ding. Oh, shit. Are he and Emma hooking up tonight? Is that what this is about? Is this the first time or a repeat? This could affect my best-laid plans, so to speak. I can't imagine how to discover the answer to that question, though. Damn, damn, damn. I fight to keep my voice even while my brain is going 100 miles per hour. So, you're going back home tomorrow, then? Did you miss class this week? He rests his chin in his hand, too. Yeah, but two are independent study, and the other two gave me a pass because I completed research papers early, so it's all good. We're in this mirrored pose, a foot apart, over the corner of the table. I ask him about his final classes as though I'm interested in the specifics of them, and perhaps I would be if I knew enough about literature to know what the hell he's talking about. I'm listening just closely enough to reply and form questions while I'm cataloging details I haven't had the chance to savor in a while. I've said that Graham is the best-looking guy in the cast. A towering claim, considering the fact that Reed, Quentin, and Tad are no fugly ducklings, and are constantly publicized as Hollywood's hottest young celebs. Quentin is solid-cut musculature, while Tad embodies the buff surfer look, and Reed is so beautiful that sometimes I'm jealous of the perfection of his face. But Graham is all dark, smoldering male. In the hazy, subdued light of the bar and against his lighter-toned skin, his dark chocolate hair and smoky eyes are almost black. He's wearing his usual expression, cool and easygoing, but shuddered. My God, he's hot. And though he must have some idea of this, he rarely exhibits that cocky veneer that comes second nature to Reed. He's rattling off something about Dostoevsky and existentialism when suddenly he stops mid-sentence and runs a hand through his hair. One lock of hair sticks straight up in front. Sorry, that can't possibly be as fascinating to you as your acting skills indicate. His smile is self-deprecating, lashes sweeping down as he sighs. You should stop me before I get that far. Hey, I say, just because I can't even say Dostoevsky. Right, Dostoevsky. Doesn't mean I don't find something you're that enthusiastic about interesting. That adorable cowlick is begging me to reach out and blend it in with the rest of his hair, but I recall what Reed had to say about my casual touches in front of Emma, and I keep my hands to myself with immense effort. Having raised the thought of her in my head, I have to fight the urge to check if she's even watching. Graham clears his throat and glances down the table at her. I'm crossing my fingers that he at least forgot all about her for the space of that little literary exchange, even if he's recalling her existence now. When he smiles and winks at her, I want to emit a sharp little scream and stomp like I used to do as a small child whenever someone told me no. His eyes swing back to mine, and I swallow that outburst and smile instead. Emma. Graham is leaving California in the morning. I'm enjoying interacting with everyone, celebrating Michonne's engagement to David, but I'm hyper-aware of the hours and minutes ticking away. His wink is a tiny electrical zap, darting a zing of pleasure through me. He's sitting at the other end of the table, with Brooke hanging on his every word, and I'm trying not to be jealous or concerned. That attempt isn't going so well. I tell myself that I'm only jealous of the time I'm losing with him, which rings half true and half hollow. Emma, I hear you and Reed are doing Ellen. Meredith snaps me out of my gloomy trance. Yeah, in a couple of weeks. I'm scared to death.
No need to be scared, Reed says, swinging his attention to our conversation. She's just as nice in person as she seems.
You said that about Ryan, I accuse, smirking. Are you going to tell me that every time?
I was right, wasn't I?
And no, if someone's going to be tough, I'll give you a heads up. Promise? He hooks my pinky with his. Promise. And for the record, I've never broken a pinky swear. And how many pinky swears have you made, Mr. Alexander? Meredith asks.
arms folded loosely over her chest as she leans back to watch our discussion play out in front of her.
Meredith, he says, that's classified information, top secret. Plus, I tried the Boy Scout promise on her months ago, and she promptly accused me of never having been a Boy Scout. Imagine.
He blinks innocently, and we can't help but laugh. This far away from the humiliation of last fall, his wicked reputation feels less personal. Lips flattened, Meredith says, yes, imagine. I'm thinking this is numero uno pinky swear for you, buddy. Our fingers are still hooked on the table in front of Meredith, who angles one eyebrow in question before I withdraw my hand and give Reed a stern look. Okay, I'm choosing to believe you and your pinky swear. Don't blow that trust. He looks back, steadily, suddenly more serious than he was seconds ago. I won't. It takes forever for the hallway in front of my door to clear. Graham's room is on the same floor, but two turns and a couple dozen rooms away from mine. I text him when everything grows quiet, and I haven't seen a soul pass my peephole in 5 minutes. It's nearly 2 a.m. When he walks up to the door, I swing it open silently and try to close it just as quietly. He's wearing jeans and canvas flip-flops and holding the ice bucket from his room.
This is your idea of subterfuge?
I whisper, pointing at the bucket and trying not to laugh. He pretends offense.
The vending area is between our rooms, so I thought it made more sense than pretending to be lurking in the hall for no apparent reason.
I take the bucket from his hands. It's still empty. He rolls his eyes.
Well, duh. I wasn't going to waste time getting actual ice.
I've left one small lamp glowing in the corner, and his black eyes regard me in the dim light. While waiting for the hallway to clear, I changed into a dark violet shorts and tank set from Victoria's Secret that Emily gave me before I left town. Purple is the I'm a woman version of pink, she cautioned, fixing me with a knowing look. Graham's slow perusal is like a caress, leaving me breathless and feeling somehow powerful and vulnerable at once. He raises one eyebrow.
Unless we need it for something kinky.
My blush is immediate, and I turn to put the ice bucket on my sink counter in an effort to hide it, in case the low lighting isn't enough. His arms slide around me from behind, his cheek nuzzling and stroking my hair back from my neck. His lips are warm, and I'm glad he's supporting me because my legs feel boneless as he places light, sucking kisses from the curve between my shoulder and neck to the sensitive hollow behind my ear.
If I traced an ice cube along this line, he murmurs, it would melt instantly because your skin is so hot.
I gasp lightly, imagining his tongue following a line of icy water sluicing down my neck. Turning me gently, his hands are in my hair and then his mouth is on mine, so gentle and slow that kissing him feels like a dream. I don't want to wake up. A minute later, I find my calves hitting the edge of the mattress as they did 2 nights ago. I scarcely have the capacity to register the question of how he manages to transport me all the way across a room without my notice before he lifts me into the center of the bed, still kissing me. Rolling to his back, Graham's strong hands pull me halfway over his body, one palm on my thigh and the other cradling my head. His jeans are rough against my bare legs, but he's kicked off his shoes somewhere between the door and the bed. My knee falls between his legs as he angles up, never breaking his mouth from mine for more than half a second. His hand runs along my back from shoulder to waist, lightly over my hip, and down the leg that presses between his. His heart hammers beneath my hand, matching the tempo of my own, and I'm not content to lie here and let him find his equilibrium. When I lift my hand from his chest and slide it under his shirt, he makes a noise between his teeth, tss, like I've burned him.
God, Emma.
His hand covers mine with the t-shirt between us. I spread my fingers over his abdomen and his breath catches. At first, he doesn't loosen his hold, stilling my hand with his. Distracting him with kisses, I wait until his grip goes slack. and when it does, I set my fingers to roam slowly over his sleek skin and hard muscle, moving under his shirt soundlessly. He holds himself very still, but when my fingers glide lower to the waistband of his jeans, his eyes flash open and stare into mine, his hand clasping mine again. "You can't sleep in your jeans," I say, repressing the urge to giggle at this deceptively rational argument for why he should remove his pants in my bed. "I probably should." We're both whispering as though everyone in the hotel will be able to hear us if our voices rise to regular levels. "Graham, I'm not going to take advantage of you. I promise." I hold up two fingers, Reed's silly months-ago vow still front and center from our conversation earlier tonight. "Scout's honor." "Oh my God," he says, laughing softly. He caresses my face, his thumb moving over my lower lip as his expression transforms from amusement to want. "I can't promise the same thing, and that's why." My eyes slide from his and he takes an unsteady breath. "Besides, I didn't bring anything with me tonight. As in, protection." He didn't bring condoms. Which means he wasn't just assuming we weren't going to. He was actively planning that we weren't going to. I bite my lip. "So you don't want—" "I want. Hell, yes, I want. 3 weeks, remember? I need to, get tested when I get home, too." When my eyes widen, he adds, "I'm sure everything is fine, because I've always been careful." His mouth twists. "Well, ever since Kara, I've been careful. I was a whole lot of stupid before that, because you always believe that stuff is never going to happen to you until it does." I find myself wondering how many girls there have been. And then I wonder if Brooke was ever one of them, even if it didn't result in a relationship, even if it was casual. I want to ask, but the questions are stuck in my throat and won't get near the surface. I shouldn't be surprised. He's much too good at this to have been celibate since his daughter was born. He hasn't asked me about my sexual history at all, and I wonder if he doesn't care, or if my inexperience is just that freaking obvious. "Hey." He takes my chin between his fingertips, obliging me to look at him. I need both of us to be sure. His finger traces the frown line on my forehead. "Please don't worry whether this has anything to do with wanting you. It doesn't." I don't ask about the multitude of girls I imagined parading through his bed. I don't ask about Brooke. I just sigh and curl up against his chest, though I don't remove my hand from under his shirt. Gained ground is gained ground. "Okay." I feel distinctly pouty. Laughing quietly, his arms encircle me. "I'm not ready to stop kissing you, you know," he says. "I didn't know," I mumble into his shirt. "Well, now you do." I lean my head back on his arm, my eyes meeting his. "So many warnings, so little action," I sigh. He growls and flips me onto my back, and we don't fall asleep until close to 4 a.m. In the end, his jeans are in a heap on the floor, and my tank is decidedly askew, and he's taken at least 3 very serious breaks. Inexperience or not, I'm reasonably certain this adds up in my favor.
Chapter 15. Graham. I was convinced Emma would cause me to internally combust last night. It's a lucky thing my sense of responsibility is so unswerving, because at some point between arriving in her room and falling asleep, I no longer cared whether or not she loved me. The desire was so powerful and overwhelming that my sense of emotional self-preservation was prepared to toss itself out the window and to hell with it. I must have suspected that weakness skulking below the surface, which was why I left my wallet, and the condom inside it, in my room when I went to hers. I know myself that well, at least. Using protection is second nature. Not once since Zoe have I had unprotected sex. I promised Emma 3 weeks, and I'm willing to keep that promise, as worried as I might be that she doesn't feel as strongly as I do.
I suppose love is never a sure thing, no matter what words are spoken. Love requires a leap of faith into the abyss, every time. I scribble a sappy note to leave on her nightstand. My sisters call me an old-fashioned boy. Perhaps this is the result of too much close reading and analyzing of 18th-century literature. Even still, there are romantic, old-school sides of myself I've never fully unleashed, and for some reason, Emma brings every one of them to the surface. Zoe didn't care to be courted. When I left notes in her locker or under her windshield wiper, she asked if she had to respond in kind and also why couldn't I just text her like a normal person. And though she appreciated having an armful of carnations delivered from the choir Cupid on Valentine's Day, she paid little attention to the attached poem that took me a week to write. Relatively sure that I was past such unmanly silliness by the time I met Emma, my feelings for her slammed into me, unexpected and inspiring. All of a sudden, I found myself rivaling Keats and Rilke for romantic musings. The first note I left for Emma was in Austin, after she told me about her mother's death and we fell asleep watching television. That one was the result of several longer, more maudlin versions. I left the abbreviated edition on her night table and threw the others away in my room. Since then, I've crafted poems to her in my head, discarded without being jotted down, written her two letters, put through the shredder in Mom's home office, and tapped out multiple soul-bearing texts, deleted without even being saved to drafts. As I pull her door shut and it locks behind me, I have a 2-second panic attack about the note I just left for her before I take a deep breath and head for my room. There's no taking it back, apart from the fact that I don't actually want to. I round the corner and inexplicably, Brooke is standing in front of me. Graham? Her expression is bemused, head at an angle like a bemused puppy. She frowns at the ice bucket in my hand. Are you getting ice? She points back to where the vending alcove is, which I'd have passed if I was coming from my room. No? My mind is blank. I have no idea what to offer as an excuse. Thank God I'm wearing pants. She glances behind me towards Emma's door, but thankfully, she doesn't voice the question that flashes through her eyes, because I'd have to tell her it's none of her business, which would answer her curiosity in any case. For some reason, she directs her best faux smile at me. I seldom get the faux smile from Brooke. Are you about to check out? She asks. Her Louis Vuitton overnight bag is slung over her shoulder, D&G sunglasses perched on her head, and I'm not sure what label the stilettos are, but I'd be willing to bet they're the ones with the red undersides. She's a walking L.A. girl stereotype. Yeah, I've got to grab a quick shower and then get a taxi to LAX. I can take you, she shrugs and turns to walk to my room with me. It's not like I have a book schedule. And we didn't get to hang out much this trip. I have been focused on Emma for the past 3 days. I didn't consider that Brooke might want FaceTime, too. Oh, okay, cool. Thanks. When we get to my room, I tell her to make herself at home while I shower. 20 minutes later, we're crossing the lobby as Reed is coming in with his bodyguard. You two leaving? He asks, unnecessarily since we're both holding luggage. I'm anticipating Brooke's sure to be acerbic answer when she says, without a trace of condescension, Yeah, I'm taking Graham to the airport. Cool. He shoves his mirrored shades up and sticks a hand out. See you guys in 3 weeks, eh? I shake his hand and then he gives Brooke a quick hug as I begin to wonder what kind of twilight zone I've entered. When he walks off, I'm staring at her, perplexed. Sunglasses in place. She says, What? I shake my head. Oh, I don't know, possibly the hug and friendly banter with a guy I nearly decked in the middle of a nightclub for you a few months ago. She shrugs. I guess we needed to get that shit out of the way. It was all a long time ago. I'm trying to move past it, okay? I nod. Sure. Okay. A valet pulls up with her black 2-seater Mercedes, and I put our bags in the trunk while she tips him. I've barely clicked my seatbelt in place when she pulls into traffic. So tell me, just how serious is this thing with Emma? Her tone is very nonchalant. We're not really revealing anything about it yet. My attempt at being evasive earns me a smirk. Yeah, I figured that much. Because of the studio edict for Reed and Emma to look like a real-life love match? Who told you about that? She flips her hand off the top of the steering wheel. He did, I guess. I don't remember. This is more and more odd. So now they're chatting? Glancing at me through her sunglasses, she says, "You can tell me, right? You know I won't say anything to the freaking media." In 4 years of friendship, Brooke has never given me a reason not to trust her. "All right, it's semi-serious." She shoots me a look over the top of her sunglasses. I shrug and look out the window. And I want it to be more than semi. Her faux smile is back, but she's directing it out the windshield. "That's new for you, isn't it, though?" "Yes."
Reed. When I'm packing up, I text John to find out if he wants to go out tonight, and he calls me back while I wait in the lobby for the valet to bring my car around. "Hell yeah, you know I'm game," he says. "Any ideas?" "I was hoping you had something. No clubs. I've got studio orders of exclusive coupledom until the premiere. Can't risk taking anyone home if it could get leaked. Not to mention the fact that Brooke will hang me up by my balls if I screw up this elaborate scheme of hers. Any private parties?" John's network includes plenty of the bored rich kids of L.A.'s most prominent cosmetic surgeons, Hollywood execs, and professionals like our dads. He's even better connected for that shit than I am. "Yeah, sure. There's at least one or two that might not prove lame. Pick you up at 10? "Cool." John and I have known each other for 3 years, ever since a party during which I thought I was going to die. I was hitting on this girl, and she was hitting back like a pro. We found a shadowy spot near the pool waterfall to make some semi-stoned explorations and get better acquainted. All fine and good until someone yanked me away from her with the clear intent of ripping my arm from its socket. Apparently she had a boyfriend who was a bit disappointed to find her with her shirt hanging open and one hand down the front of my jeans. "What the fuck do you think you're doing?" he screamed, eyes crazy and swinging back and forth between us. His hand was still clenched around my nearly dislocated arm as she stumbled backwards. He was smaller than me, but older, and really pissed off. When he let go, I tried to just retreat and take the loss. No sense getting my ass kicked for some girl who hadn't bothered to volunteer her name or ask mine, as far as I could remember. "Nothing, man, seriously," I mumbled, still high but sobering up fast. Unfortunately, my unzipped jeans and the fact that she was fumbling to rebutton her shirt contradicted my words. He stepped closer to me, his wiry neck muscles bulging. "I'm gonna kill you!" That's when John popped up next to me. I'd never seen him before. "Hey, do I know you?" At first, I thought he meant me, but a quick glance told me he meant pissed off guy. "Back off, dickwad!" The guy stabbed a finger at me. "This is between me and him." "Oh yeah? This is my house, so why don't you back off?" John was smaller than both of us, but he was gushing righteous indignation. That's when pissed off guy's 6'4" linebacker width friend materialized. Gaping at him, I thought, "I'm dead. Holy shit, I'm totally dead." Expressionless, he stared back as I contemplated whether or not it was even remotely possible for me to get in one punch that might stun him long enough for me to make a run for it. I couldn't look away from his glassy-eyed gaze until he cracked his knuckles. I swallowed, trying one last stab at conciliation with the pissed-off boyfriend. "Hey, sorry, dude, I didn't know she was taken." "Not good enough, dude," he sneered, unappeased. He didn't want apologies. He wanted blood. Mine. That's when John sidestepped me and meaty guy, all 140 pounds of him, barreling straight into pissed off guy. Knocking the guy flat on his ass, he commenced to beat the shit out of him, fists flying. "Great," I thought, my eyes sliding back to the huge thug whose neck was the size of one of my thighs. "Now I'm definitely getting my ass kicked." I stood straight, fists clenched, certain that if that guy landed one punch, I was going to be A, unconscious, and B, not nearly as attractive as I began this lousy evening. And then meaty guy breathed a deep, frustrated sigh, rolled his eyes, and leaned down to grab his friend out from under John. Making for the side gate, he towed his bleeding, stumbling comrade along. Without a word, the girl followed. This all happened in the time it took me to blink twice. Like a prize fighter, John rocked his head back and forth a couple of times, popping his neck, and then looked at me. "Come on, man, I gotta ice my knuckles." He grinned idiotically as he pumped his hands open and closed as though that would help the pain. "God damn, that hurts." I shook my head at him. Thanks? "No prob, that guy was a dick." I followed him into the house, where he opened a drawer in the freezer and rummaged through ice packs of various shapes and sizes. "My stepmom does kickboxing," he said, in explanation of the ice packs. I tried and failed to imagine my mom kickboxing. Pulling a hand-sized pack from the freezer drawer, he said, "So you're Reed Alexander, yeah? At 16, I was still on the outer fringes a celebrity. You know who I am?" I had no idea then how much everything would change, or how quickly. Meeting John was one of the earliest indications of the approaching shift in my social status. John is one of my closest friends now, but he's always been conscious of who's who. And I've wondered if our friendship would have ever occurred if he hadn't known who I was that night. "I know Karen and Olivia, and they said they were bringing you tonight." The last glimpse I'd gotten of Karen and Olivia, they were dancing together and driving every guy in the vicinity nuts. Too bad for the guys, because neither girl would be interested in any of them. They were much more interested in each other, which is why I'd gone looking for my own amusement. Taking two beers from the fridge with his uninjured hand, John handed me one. I twisted the cap off and shook my head. "Guess I got lucky that big guy wasn't in the mood to fight, eh?" John shrugged. "The smaller guy was the douche. I figured, take him out, problem solved." "Risky guess." "Yeah, well, thanks."
Chapter 16. Emma. I wake up alone, with bits and pieces of last night and this morning floating back to me. The first thing I remember is the last thing that happened. Graham leaving a piece of paper on the night table before he leaned over, hands on either side of my head, and kissed me goodbye. I drifted back to sleep with the taste of him on my lips. I sit up a bit, scooting back against the pillows and rubbing my eyes, and the note is there where I remember him leaving it. The clock reads 11 a.m., so he must have left 3 hours ago. He's somewhere between California and New York, probably flying over a patchwork quilt of corn and wheat fields. The room-darkening draperies seal out the sunlight completely, so I have to switch the lamp on to read his note. I run the pad of my finger over his familiar scrawl, my name at the top and his at the bottom. Emma. I'm sitting next to you, with a directory balanced on my knee, watching you sleep and striving to compose something profound and passionate that will express how I feel. Something that will make you breathless, waiting for me to return. Instead, I'm the breathless one, recalling the feel of your mouth opening to me, the stroke of your fingertips everywhere you touched me, the perfect weight of you in my arms. The thought of time away from you is torture. I haven't even left your room, and I already miss you. Tonight we'll talk, and I'll tell you a story of exactly what I plan to do to you in 3 weeks. Or perhaps you'd prefer to tell me what you want, like a list of resolutions, or a treasure hunt, or crumbs along a pathway. I'm very good at following crumbs. Or instructions, directions, entreaties. Yours, Graham. Reed, are you still at the hotel? Me, yes, leaving for the airport soon. Reed, I'll drive you and we can talk about the interview schedule on the way. Me. Okay. Your car is really yellow. Yellow or not, this is the fanciest non-limousine vehicle I've ever been in. This even beats out Marcus and his Sacramento rich kid Volvo. I'm afraid to touch anything. Reed's eyes are invisible behind the sunglasses, but I can tell he's rolling them. Ugh! Don't start, woman. I'm replacing it soon anyway. I click the seatbelt in place and he takes off. Why? It looks brand new. Smirking, he says, because it's yellow. I laugh, confused. But didn't you choose it? Shrugging, he looks at me and smiles, semantics. Taking a sharp right at the corner, he says, hold on. And I'm suddenly glad for the molded seat and multiple interior handles. Were you a race car driver in a past life? I ask after he weaves through several cars like he's James Bond. Too fast for you, Emma? He asks, laughing. Damn. I'm always going too fast for you. I've got to learn to rein it in. Lips pressed tight, I glance at him. And he flips me a patented Reed Alexander smile, decreasing his speed and moving into the right lane, his hand smoothly working the gear shift between us. I'm just teasing, you know. I shrug in reply, hoping we aren't going to rehash what happened last fall, hoping he isn't going to renew his request for another chance. Everything with Graham is too new, and I'm not ready to share it or defend it to Reed. He's quiet for several minutes, tapping his fingers on the wheel along with the beat of the music. Finally, he clears his throat and says,
"So, we have a few semi-local radio and TV appearances to do. Something scheduled every day next week."
I sigh, relieved at the change of subject. "I guess I'll be back in L.A. Monday, then." He nods once.
"Most are morning shows beginning at totally unacceptable times of day, starting with Monday morning at 6.
6 a.m.? Crap."
He shakes his head. "That word is nowhere near strong enough for anything that begins at 6 a.m. The first one's at a local L.A. station, though. I'll drive or get a car and pick you up at your hotel, so don't worry about transportation. Actually, I might as well handle that for all of them. We don't want anyone talking to us separately, if at all possible, what with our romantic charade." He smiles at me again, but playfully. No reason for alarm. The coming week will include lots of one-on-one time with Reed. Not long ago, I'd have been euphoric over a chance like that. Now it makes me nervous in a whole different way. Though I no longer want a relationship with him, he's still charismatic and curiously easy to be around, most of the time. I should feel more distrustful and wary. That's the problem, really. I'm not totally on guard when every logical cell in my body tells me I should be. But then that's the sort of thing at which Reed Alexander excels, faking trustworthiness. The rest of the trip is filled with small talk. He asks what I'm planning to study in college, and I ask about his upcoming project, an action film opposite Chelsea Radin, a small-town weather girl turned hot celebrity. He doesn't bring up last fall or our conversation in March. When we arrive at the airport, he hops out to retrieve my bag from the trunk. Pulling the handle up and out, he presses it into my hand, and before I can react, he leans in close and brushes my cheek with a kiss. He's sliding his sunglasses back on and getting into his car, calling, "See you Monday morning," while I'm standing on the sidewalk, blinking. The kiss was an unexpected shock, even if it wasn't on the mouth and seemed oh so casual. But his mostly harmless kiss isn't what has me frozen. On the other side of the multiple one-way lanes in front of my departure gate stands a girl with a camera aimed directly at me. This is no cell phone, and no touristy $300 Kodak. It's a big, black, professional-looking piece of equipment. Damn it! As I turn away, her face breaks into a happy, evil grin before she turns, too, quickly disappearing into the parking garage. I know what just happened between Reed and me on the sidewalk, an innocuous kiss. I also know exactly how it will look on every celebrity gossip website to which that girl can upload and sell a photo. Brooke. I'm not as afraid of the paparazzi as some celebs. Very little of my life isn't an open book anyway. Aside from my one ginormous secret that somewhere out there is a most likely blonde, blue-eyed, beautiful 3-year-old with a mix of genes from Reed and me. God help whoever's trying to raise that kid if there's any truth to the nature end of the nature versus nurture debate. I have a secret weapon in my paparazzi back pocket. Her name is Rowena, and she's a female jackal amongst the pack of a male-majority profession. I chose her for that reason, in fact. Anytime I can give a woman a leg up over a man, I'm on board. As long as the woman in question isn't competition, because then all bets are off. Rowena didn't trust me at first. Not until she got 2 or 3 photos that would have never been possible without my help. Since then, when I call, she only has one word. Where? I use her for, quote-unquote, candid shots of myself, of course. That's how I got her hooked originally. I convinced her to give me her number, and then I'd call when I stopped by Starbucks for a frappuccino with a hunky co-star. I'd text where I'd be shopping with my mom. Since I control the scenarios, I appear how I want to appear, and Rowena looks like she knows how to catch hot celebrities out on the town, trying to be inconspicuous. Now the gossip rags eagerly take her calls, and I stay in the public eye,
looking like a normal, attractive person, rather than a bag lady flashing her underwear, or lack thereof, to the world. Some celebs think they're above such maneuvering, or they're just too stupid to comprehend how to work it to their advantage. I'm not high and mighty, and I'm not stupid. When I called Rowena this morning and told her to get her ass to LAX for a Reed Alexander and Emma Pierce exclusive, she asked the gate number and was off like a well-trained greyhound. Don't worry about looking for her, I told Reed last night. She's a pro. You probably won't even see her until she's already gotten the shot, if you see her at all. You are a devious little bitch, Brooke. I couldn't take much offense because there was admiration in his voice. FYI, I'm not telling you to try anything that could backset our plan. But the more you look like you're dropping your lover at the airport after a torrid night, the better. He laughed. Okay, yeah, I'll see what I can do. His kiss on her cheek was brilliant. He and Emma both know it was quick and innocent, but the photos that started popping up a few hours later could be interpreted a million ways. And very few of those interpretations are innocent. Me. I just found out I'll be in NYC the week of your graduation. I don't want to invite myself, but can I invite myself? Would your family hate me to intrude? Graham. No, I'm sure that would be fine, if you're sure you want to go. Might be a long, boring ceremony. Me. Is that a jab at my sometimes limited attention span? 'Cause I promise I'm proud of you and can sit still for the whole thing. Graham. Ha ha. Okay, sure. That would be cool. I am not content to wait a week and a half to pop up in New York. With Emma safely stuck on an L.A. publicity tour with Reed, it's the perfect time to pay a friendly impromptu visit to Graham's home turf. The romantic comedy I'm filming there in the fall calls for a short-term apartment, I think, one that could become long-term. My stated purpose for being in town will be meetings with producers, entirely feasible, so it won't be questioned. If I'm going to be with Graham, I'll have to win over his mother, his condescending sisters, and his kid. I've only seen Kara once, and it was a couple of years ago, so there's no way she remembers me. That trip also included a disastrous, drunken kissing incident that, luckily, Graham decided to play off as though it never happened. Life's a Beach was filming an episode where several characters go to New York. L.A. beach characters in New York, what the hell, right? But hey, it was ratings week, and I do what I'm paid to do. I'd somehow contrived to stay with Graham while I was in New York, so when I got word of a party in a Union Square penthouse apartment owned by the friend of one of my co-stars, I invited him along. We'd been dancing and got hot and ended up on the rooftop stargazing. Or he was. I was gazing at him. I was accustomed to guys like Reed, who take advantage of opportunities like girls drinking themselves stupid or pretending to in order to land some hot guy. I should have known Graham wouldn't respond to that. Not that he was unresponsive. When I moved into his arms and kissed him, for a few mind-blowing seconds, he kissed me back. I thought I was going to melt. It was so good. And then he grabbed my shoulders and held me away, saying, "Brooke, no." I was just wasted enough that I didn't realize what he was doing at first. And once I figured it out, I was just sober enough to be humiliated and pissed. God, I was pissed. I stormed back inside, shaking and furious, and grabbed the first decent-looking guy I encountered. Backing him against a wall with the thump of the music pounding through the sheetrock and into us both, I closed my eyes and pretended he was who I wanted. I don't remember much about that part. Just that I couldn't fool myself, no matter how hard I tried. Moments later, Graham separated me from the guy, who nearly slid to the floor because I hadn't really allowed him to breathe. "Let's go," he said, his hand gripping my arm. I yanked loose, crossed my arms, and glared. "I'm not finished with this party." "Yeah, you are," he said, leaning in so I could hear him. "You're completely trashed, and you're going to do something you'll regret if we don't leave now." His proximity was killing me. "I already did," I mumbled, my eyes filling. I blinked back the tears and pinched my own forearms, determined to stay enraged. "What?" I snapped my arms straight, fists at my side. I felt hard but brittle,
like I was made of concrete. One solid whack and I'd crumble into dust. I said I already did. You're going to hate me now, and I've ruined our friendship. My voice broke again, and I realized I was more angry at myself than I was at him. I just want someone to care about. Why is that so wrong? He closed his eyes. It's not wrong. When he put his arm around me and led me to the door, I didn't fight him. We walked a couple of blocks before I pulled to a stop and whined that my feet hurt and I was tired, and he hailed a taxi to take us back to his parents' house. It was late, and the house was quiet. He stopped outside the guest room door, his voice hushed. "Brooke, you haven't ruined anything." He sighed. "Can we just forget this happened? You mean a lot to me. You're one of the few friends I have who even know about Kara. You had a lot to drink. It was a silly mistake. And I could never hate you." For a moment, before I call my travel agent and make reservations for a Tuesday flight, I mull over that sentence. I could never hate you. What it meant to me at the time. What it means to me now. And I almost chicken out. But I'm right for him. I know it. I just need the chance to prove it.
Chapter 17. Reed. No matter how many times we've woken up hungover, or how many times we've mumbled, "I will never do that again," to ourselves and each other, John and I tend to slam back drinks until we can't see straight the next time we go out. The exception is when we get high instead. We didn't even bother with a hangover Saturday morning. We just went straight into the next binge, making Sunday's hangover a real bastard. It's late afternoon before either of us can move, and somewhere in the back of my mind is the nagging philosophical question of the moment: was it fun if I don't remember it? There's some chick passed out on John's couch, and neither of us remember who was responsible for bringing her back to his apartment, or what was done with her once she was here. For all I know, we all fell asleep. Her makeup is smeared to hell and she's lying on her stomach, with her skirt and top weirdly twisted, lots of skin exposed, and all four limbs extended as though she were tossed there. "She's kind of tall." "Probably yours," I say, due to John's known weakness for models. "She's kind of blonde. Probably yours," he returns. He prods her hip with his foot. "Hey, wake up." She releases an annoyed grunt, but otherwise doesn't react. This is really, truly wrong and insanely hilarious. Unfortunately, it hurts my head to laugh. Shit, John, she's not a bum. He exhales and blinks slowly, his eyes squinting at her in the not-that-bright light of day. The blinds are still shut tight. "Dude, I beg to differ. She's unconscious, somewhere she doesn't belong, where nobody knows who she is. That's pretty much the definition of a bum." He leans over and tries nudging her shoulder, with his hand this time. She moans again, and he recoils. Oh, for Christ's sake, her breath sure smells like a bum's. I dig my phone out of the jeans I was wearing last night, which I find slung over the back of a nearby chair. "I'll call a cab. You find some ID, we'll load her in, throw some 20s at the cabbie, and send her on her way." Holding his head, John casts around for a purse while I make the call. "Wallet," he says finally, his hand emerging from between the sofa cushions. "Okay, who are you?" "The taxi will be out front in 5. I collapse into the chair just as John utters a string of curse words at a much too elevated volume. "Damn it, John, shut the hell up," I hiss, pressing my palms to my temples. "Yeah, okay, look," he hands me her ID. I don't recognize the name or address, but the taxi sure as hell won't do any good. Shit, San Diego? We can't send an unconscious girl to San Diego in a cab. John shakes his head minutely. "No, man, that's not the problem." He lets loose with another string of curses, softer this time, staring at her like she's a zombie and any second she's going to wake up and attack. "What then?" I ask, and he hands me another ID. I didn't really look at the photo of the first one, or the age. I do now. The photo could be her, 21-year-old Amber Lipscomb, until I look at the second ID, which is clearly the girl on the sofa. 17-year-old April Hollinsworth. Oh, shit. I knew the club was a bad idea. I knew it. We are so screwed. He stares at Zombie Girl, no longer making any effort to wake her up. My phone launches into its ringtone, startling us both. "Yeah?" I croak, mouth parched and heart rate spiked, and I thought my head was pounding before. Ha. Okay, thanks. I look at John. The taxi's here. His eyes swing to me. Put your pants on and get out of here, man. Are you serious? He's staring at her again, wary. I'm nobody. She can't prove shit about who she was with last night, and there's only so far she can get with the damned good fake in her possession and being in a 21-up club. We're 19, which makes this a misdemeanor at worst. No one will do anything to me for such a minor offense, but someone would find a way to make you pay for it. So get out of here. John and I have been in tight spots before, but this is probably an all-time low. If this goes poorly, his father will torch him. I never could have imagined John throwing himself on that grenade for me. I can't wrap my brain around it. Look, you woke up in your room, I woke up in the guest room, and clearly she hasn't budged from the sofa since she landed there. Maybe nothing happened. Maybe, he snorts. Reed, take that taxi and go home, and perform some sort of ritualistic sacrifice once you get there, man. I'll call you later.
Emma. Derek and Emily picked me up at the airport Friday afternoon, and almost 48 hours later, they're dropping me back off. Riding in Derek's Jeep gives me a deja vu of my excursion to Griffith Park with Graham. I pull my hair into a ponytail and recall the pleasure of huddling together to watch the sun rise, and the feel of his mouth on my neck as he murmured, "You're so beautiful." I've reread his note several dozen times, and only the fear of it being ripped from my grasp by a gust of wind keeps me from pulling it out now. Our 3 weeks are counting down. I didn't know, last fall, in my back-and-forth skirmishes with Reed, that this is how it's supposed to feel. Not relentless internal questions of, should I give in or am I ready yet? Not a constant feeling of defending my borders, but yearning for this next step, this connection. An inherent trust that it means everything it should mean. From the back seat, I watch Derek and Emily communicate without speaking, something they've probably learned to do of necessity in this open-air vehicle. Their hands are clasped over the center console, his strong tan forearm brushing against her paler, fragile-looking skin. I can't help but smile. Thanks to the Jeep and a host of new outdoor activities, Emily has actual tan lines. They're the faintest tan lines ever due to her liberal all-over use of sunblock, but still. Derek has gotten my best friend into rock climbing recently, something that made Mrs. Watson stop speaking to him for a week except for under her breath asides about danger and her baby girl and imminent death. Emily says he finally made a concerted effort to explain all the details of the pulley system and the fact that as a novice, Emily was always hooked up to it, in the end convincing her mother that he would allow absolutely nothing to happen to the girl he loved. It was all very sitcom sappy, Emily told me Saturday morning as we lounged in her bed. I told Derek he wasn't allowed to speak to my mother that way, all that mushy stuff, which of course bonded them immediately. Her sly smile made me laugh out loud, and I wondered how Dad and Chloe would handle the news of Graham and me. By Friday night, photos of me with Reed outside LAX were plastered all over the internet, along with rampant speculations about our possible relationship. I figured that this crap falls under need to know, Emily sighed, turning her monitor to face me. The time of day he dropped me off, some sites insisted, confirmed the probability of our having spent the night together. I texted Graham so he wouldn't be caught unaware, again, of a seemingly intimate photo of me with Reed. He texted back, "Vultures, thanks for letting me know." Emily wasn't the only one who kept an eye out for incriminating photos of me. I should have known right away from Chloe's patronizing questions over dinner last night that she'd discovered them too, but my mind was so occupied with thoughts of Graham and his promises for our Skype time later that I was running on autopilot answers and all but ignoring her. When she passed the vinaigrette, she said, "Emma, you sneaky thing. How was L.A.?" I dribbled dressing over my salad, vowing to squeeze in a long run in the morning. "It was fine. Pretty clear this trip, actually," I said, alluding to L.A. weather and the always welcome lack of haze. As I passed the bottle to Dad, Chloe gave him a self-satisfied, "See there?" sort of look, which made him frown. Everything is definitely clearer lately. This was a Chloe attempt at being cryptic, but nothing about my stepmother is ever obscure or even vaguely mysterious. Her thoughts and designs are transparent, unconstrained by silly social constructs like tact or poise. I've learned to count this as one of her positive traits, in the same way you know a shark is capable of biting your arm off because you can see the teeth. First, I registered the fact that she called me sneaky, and then the clearer comment. Recognition dawned. Ah, you've seen photos. I turned to Dad's concerned eyes. You know how Dan said that the studio wants Reed and me to look like a couple until the premiere? Well, that's what we're doing, just so you know. Nothing is actually going on between us. Why in the world not? Chloe was incredulous. He's gorgeous! Dad's frown turned into a scowl. For God's sake, Chloe. I don't want my daughter hooking up or whatever with that adolescent Casanova. I almost choked on a tomato hearing my father say, hooking up, which he air-quoted. Chloe sighed heavily and rolled her eyes like she was 12. I'm just saying that since she's abandoning the film industry, she's not likely to get a shot at anyone like him ever again. All the better, Dad countered, following that with a harumph as he stabbed a fork full of salad and stuffed it in his mouth. I glared at both of them. Excuse me, I'm sitting right here, and in case you've both forgotten, I'm a legal adult, and I'm perfectly capable of conducting my own affairs, such as they are. My face warmed, matched by Dad's. Now probably wasn't the time to bring up my new relationship with Graham. I cleared my throat. I'm going to finish my salad in my room. Graham devoted time to me late each evening, but he was otherwise engaged in being a dad to Kara and studying for finals. He warned me that he'd be busy reviewing for exams and finishing up final edits on research papers over the coming week, and then his mouth quirked adorably. But as of Friday, I'm all yours. I'm content to have something distract me, even if it means hotel rooms, getting up before dawn, and spending time with Reed, driving around L.A. and the surrounding areas. There are a lot of hours to fill outside of the hour or so I'll spend each night swapping life stories with Graham and asking him in whispers to compose his alternate stories of us. Fairy tale lives we would have had if we'd met under different circumstances, or if we'd never been actors at all. The story he devises tonight, my first night back in L.A., supposes that we'd met as regular high school students, something neither of us had ever been. I'd have been a senior at 17 instead of a college sophomore, and you'd have been 14, so a freshman, wide-eyed and innocent, though I guess that sort of describes you now, too. His smile is teasing, but warm. So maybe it isn't so difficult to imagine. I lean my head in my hand, my eyes drinking in his face on my laptop screen. You would have been popular, though. Why would you be interested in a freshman when you could have had your pick of any girl in the school? He shakes his head. I would have seen you the first day trying to get your locker open. He's referring to the first time he saw me, in the hallway of the hotel in Austin. Immediately intrigued, I'd have walked over, acting all cool but shaking inside, thinking, who is this beautiful girl? Need some help? I'd say, and you'd look at me, all suspicious. I'd brush your fingers aside gently and say, what's your combination? But you'd be too smart for that.
I would?
I laugh. I think maybe I'd just forget it on the spot if you talked to me. He laughs too. Nah, you'd say, but I'm not supposed to tell anyone my locker combination. And then I'd say, don't worry, I'm safe. His smile is positively wicked. I'd have melted to a puddle on the floor if he'd said any such thing to 14-year-old me. After more assurances and against all better judgment, you'd give me the combination and I'd open the locker for you. Then I'd lean on the adjacent locker and say, I require a small fee for damsels in locker opening distress, you know. Your suspicion would come back full force, your eyes narrowing, waiting for me to tell you this supposed fee. I'd tell you that you had to go out with me Friday because there's a mandatory orientation party, and since you have to go, so you might as well go with me. Oh, smooth.
You'd get that little pensive frown you get sometimes, and you'd say, "Huh, no one said anything about a mandatory orientation." He taps his finger against his chin, and I laugh at his reference to my favorite habitual word. So then I'd say, "Oh, it's only for special freshmen. You have to be invited by a senior. Now you're completely convinced that I'm full of crap." "Sounds like a hazing charge waiting to happen," you'd say. "No, no, would I lie to you?" I'd say, oozing 17-year-old boy charm. "Were you this cheesy when you were 17?" I ask. He grins. "Emma, I'm trying to tell a story here, and I plead the fifth. Sorry." So then you'd floor me. You'd say, "I don't know, would you lie to me?" And I would look into your eyes and see everything I could ever want. I'd say, "Let's skip the party. I'll take you to dinner, and then I'll take you somewhere private and kiss you until you tell me to quit." What would your answer be, Emma? I could barely breathe. "Oh, I think for the sake of the story, I'd probably be okay with that." "You think?" His mouth turns up on one side, and I can tell he's watching me on his screen as closely as I'm watching him. "I don't know. I need more information about the kissing." He chuckles softly. "Let's say you tell me yes, and we go to dinner. We talk, and we're both surprised at how comfortable we feel. And then we get into my car and drive to a secluded spot overlooking our sleepy little suburban town. Totally private. Dark but for a sky full of stars. And tomorrow I'll tell you what happens next." The noise that comes from my throat is half growl and half whimper, and he hmms. "I need to study a bit more tonight, if I even can now. And you have to get up before 5 a.m. and be animated and personable on camera." I couldn't care less about being animated or personable. "More tomorrow? You won't forget?" "Hell no, I won't forget," he says, grinning. "At this point, I'll be lucky if it doesn't work its way into my essay on the lost colony of Roanoke during my final for early settlements of colonial America. I can see it now. No evidence of what happened to the 114 colonists was ever found. But in my dream last night, I took Emma parking and got to third base." "Graham!" I laugh, hands over my mouth. "I'm kidding. I wouldn't go for third on the first date. Maybe second?" He laughs softly when I cover my face completely. "It's probably just as well you didn't meet me when I was 17. I was kind of a horn dog. But I think I'd have known enough to be careful and slow with you. At least I will in this story. To be continued tomorrow." I'll never get to sleep now. Chapter 18. Brooke. Rowena and I don't make eye contact as she shuffles through first class on her way to coach, her bag of camera equipment weighing her skinny shoulder into a sharp downward slope. She looks like a lopsided scarecrow. I can easily imagine her slipping into narrow, impossible spaces, getting shots the large, aggressive men of her kind, the ones who scare the crap out of celebs with their obnoxious belligerence, could never get. The only thing unnerving about Rowena is her eyes. They're not empty, like some psycho killer. They're just flat-out ruthless. Not that I can talk. She generally doesn't have to leave the L.A. area to make a living, but she understands the strategic part of doing personal favors for the right people, and I'm one of those people. Graham and I may not be A-listers, but we're close enough to make news if the story is juicy, especially with the movie premiere a couple of weeks away. I've made it clear to Rowena that this favor is non-negotiable if she expects a continuance of tips like the Reed and Emma bonus that probably paid several months' rent. I'm paying her airfare and hotel, plus she'll be compensated for the photos themselves. Now all I have to do is get Graham into the picture. I hate long flights alone because there's nothing to do. God knows I'm not going to chat up the middle-aged CEO or whatever he is sitting next to me. He reminds me of my dad. From the stereotypical Rolex and custom-made suit to the trainer-maintained body and bleached teeth. Daddy Dearest is on his fourth marriage to someone too young for him. As I get older, they're getting closer and closer to my age. I just turned 20. How can he be okay with the fact that his newest Mrs. Cameron is 5 or 6 years older than his youngest daughter? I think my oldest sister is actually her same age. You'd think he'd at least have the awareness to be embarrassed. My mother was the idiot second wife, the younger woman who attracted a powerful married man away from his wife and two daughters and got knocked up with me, probably on purpose. By the time his divorce was settled and the prenup my unwitting mother agreed to was inked, I was a month old. Inexplicably, I was in their farcical wedding photos, which my mother filed through the shredder when my father left her for wife number three. Hello, who didn't see that coming? Why didn't either of them think I'd eventually grow old enough to look at those framed photos and figure out that I'm beyond illegitimate, or that my friends wouldn't come to the same conclusion? Mom is currently prowling for husband number four. Number two, Rick, was actually okay. I sort of miss him. Number three was a huge douche, and I was more than happy to get my own apartment in L.A. when Mom moved back to Texas with him. Good riddance. She now says that her third marriage was the 15-minute variety. In actuality, it lasted around a year, but maybe 15 minutes just refers to how long either of them remained faithful. Mr. CEO